This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is the one and only Alan Parsons. Alan, good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So how's your back?
Oh, you heard. I've had some back problems over the years, and my doctor or orthopedist suggested that I do this procedure because it suddenly flared up a month ago, and sadly I had to cancel an entire European tour. But I got the surgery. It's now been 3 weeks, and I'm slowly getting better, but it's nice of you to ask.
What was the surgery?
It was called decompression of L2, L3, and L3 to L4, if that means anything to
actually,
the average
person.
Oh, it does?
And are you in pain now? Or are you okay?
Just a little bit. I'm not using painkillers, and I'm fine when I'm sitting down or lying down. But I'm perfectly comfortable right now.
So when might we see you back on the road?
We have gigs in November. I don't think we're going to make anything happen before then, just to be safe. But plenty going on in the new year as well. So,
and are you working now primarily just to have fun, or do you need the money?
Everybody needs the money.
That's true. There's never enough money.
I've been keeping busy in the studio. I just had Dolby Atmos installed in my studio, so I've been experimenting with that, and I'm hoping to do some remixing. I'm hoping that the iRobot album will be the next from the APP catalog. I'm also working with David Pack from Ambrosia. He wants a Dolby Atmos mix of his first two albums. And I've also been working with the drummer of Lenny Kravitz's band. His name is Franklin Vanderbilt. And I've done a whole album with him, and we've just got some touch-ups to do on that, and then it'll be finished.
Tell me about your take on Dolby Atmos.
It's a little soon for me to say, because I've literally only had it here a week now. And I was pretty happy with 5.1 and got very used to it. I mean, it's just more speakers to think about. That's really what it's all about. I mean, we've got four speakers in the ceiling, and that makes a difference. And two side speakers. I'm pointing.
Right, we don't have video, but I think it's
okay. You can see me, and nobody else can. Yeah, we've got four speakers in the ceiling and two new speakers at the side. So, I mean, it's infinitely variable how you place sounds. I found that with 5.1, you quickly ran out of ideas about where to put things, you know, what you put in the back channels and what you'd keep in the front channels and so on. But I've come to enjoy multi-channel sound generally, so I'm very hopeful that Atmos will work for me.
Well, you know, if you listen to Apple, which most people are listening to two-channel, the remixes so far sound, in most cases, radically different from the originals. Now, unlike with you, doesn't tend to be the same mixer that it was originally, but the vocals are down in the mix. I mean, we've lived through so many iterations of sound. I mean, mono to stereo was a big jump, but quad and all these other things, they never seem to ultimately gain hold. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Atmos.
Yes. It's the buzzword. I mean, everybody in the industry is talking about it. It seems to be the new fashion. And interestingly, I'm curious to know why Americans call it Atmos, because you don't use the word atmosphere. You don't say atmosphere. So I'm on a kind of a quest to get people to say Atmos, not Atmos.
Well, good luck with that.
You can be the first.
Absolutely. Okay. So you have a new album.
Repeat after me, Atmos.
Atmos.
Close.
I'm going to leave it at that. We'll see what the public decides on if they continue to use Atmos or Atmos as sound, irrelevant of the moniker and how you pronounce it. So you have a new album from the New World. It's entitled Why Now? Why a new album now?
Well, I was reasonably overdue for another album. The last album, The Secret, came out, I think it was 2019, so 3 years. Frankly, the COVID outbreak actually helped, because, everybody that I worked with on the new album was fully vaccinated or had already got over COVID, and so I was able to work in person with the band. So that worked out really well. Whereas, of course, we could not play live. That was absolutely taboo particularly in 2021. I mean, 2021 just was a disaster for everybody. It might as well not have existed.
Okay, reading the credits of the album, you know, multiple studios are used. You use Blackbird in Nashville. So did you actually go there, or were these done remote?
We did the stuff in Nashville remote. There's this great program called Source Connect, which allows us to interact as if they were in the room. All we have to do is send them the track, and they control their own transport, but it works out really well. And you know, we can point a camera at them and do FaceTime on a phone, whatever. But it's great, because you save on hotel rooms and airfares, and they don't have to travel, so I think they're better off for it.
But you're traditionally an analog guy, and that's inherently digital. So how do you feel about that?
Well, you say I'm a inherently analog guy. I've been supporting digital ever since CD first started. I went from mixing in digital to Sony 24-track digital, which became Sony 48-track digital. I've been recording essentially digitally for quite a while now. But having said that, my studio now is, although of course I use Pro Tools like most people, which is a digital recording format. It's very high resolution digital format, but I use an analog console, and that's a joy for me, just to do everything like it used to be, setting up mics and having each mic on its own analog channel, and then committing it to Pro Tools.
And when did you stop, or did you ever stop using tape?
Oh yeah, I think a valid path would have been the first time there was not a tape machine in sight, even a digital tape machine. Yes, that was a good while ago. That was 94. So I haven't seen a tape machine basically since 94.
And what's the difference between your Neve analog?
I'm terribly sorry. I mean 2004, not 94. 94.
Yeah, that sounded pretty early.
Very much in the right. That time. No, it was 2004.
So as a practical matter, what's the difference between your analog Neve and a digital board?
It's it's just a little more tactile. Every channel has its own controls, its own sends, its own EQs, and whereas digital consoles tend to group things together, and you have to hit a button to go to a particular channel that you want to modify. Whereas on an analog board, it's not so much a control surface, but it's a information giver. It tells you what you're doing at a glance. Whereas on a digital console, that's almost impossible to assess what every channel is doing at the same time.
And what about the quality of the sound?
Well, believe it or not, digital audio is still in its infancy, and it gets better every day. Analog to digital converters, digital to analog converters get better every day. I truly believe one day we will just look back on analog tape recording as a piece of history, because we can duplicate it exactly in digital, and we'll say, well, what was wrong with digital in the first place? But it did get better. It really did get better.
And what's your take on the vinyl renaissance?
That's really interesting. I mean, that's clearly a move towards the public favoring a purer signal path to their systems. Vinyl is it's a thing you hold in your hand, and you can read the cover notes, but the sound is great, especially the. The mastering that's been going on at half speed to improve the quality yet again. I'm all in favor of it, and I just recently came back before I went into hospital from Munich in Germany, where there is clearly a move towards vinyl again. I mean, I was looking at vinyl turntables costing €160,000. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Let's be very specific. If the path is a digital path and you end up with a digital master, I'm not talking about old stuff, 60s and 70s, not modern stuff. What's the logic in cutting it in vinyl?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think it's just that people are getting back to having a really good stereo system in their homes, and a good turntable is part of that equation. I think, I mean, they might have a CD player as well, but audiophiles are definitely sort of moving towards vinyl. There's no question.
Well, as an engineer and an expert here, although I still have all my vinyl, I have multiple turntables, etc. I talk to the professional community, and they say inherently there's distortion on the record, if for no other reason the needle moves from the outer groove to the inner groove, and it's more of an affectation than the sound being better than digital at today's standards. Your take on that?
You say it's just a fashion thing, kind of.
Yeah, let's go back. In the early days of digital, and you heard, I mean, I'll use this example. I remember having the original Back in Black AC/DC CD, and I have a lot of power. I never want to hit distortion in my system. And I turn it up, and my ears would bleed. I put on the vinyl, and you could feel it, and the house would shake. Okay? People might say that was distortion, but it was palpable. But now when I listen to things, you know, resolution certainly of 96, never mind CD quality, all the experts say that, you know, that I talk to say, you like the sound of vinyl, great, but it's not more accurate and the digital original is actually better. But I'm asking you that question for your take.
If the digital original was done at a high res, like 96K or higher even, yes, I would argue that's the highest quality you're going to get. But for older recordings, I think vinyl wins out despite the pops and crackles. You know, we can put up with those.
I agree. If it's cut analog to begin with, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of people buying vinyl today are younger people who are just buying something cut in digital that's been, you know, transferred to vinyl. I don't get it.
Yeah, that is a bit weird. But
needless to say, the landscape is different in the recording industry than it used to be. I'm talking about the commercial end, the marketing end. We used to have a major label. There were a limited number of albums out there. You know, a lot of older acts, it's a disincentive. They don't even record new music anymore because they're fearful it won't reach their customers. Is that something that enters your brain?
Very much so. But I'm very pleased that I seem to have enough lasting power to at least make albums. I mean, I don't sell albums anything like how I used to. I mean, all the Alan Parsons Project albums went at least gold. Most of them went platinum or even double platinum. But, you know, I'm still here. I'm still supporting the Alan Parsons Project by playing live and enjoying it very much. So, I mean, it is a worry. I mean, there's a lot of British bands in particular who just are terrified to put out another album in case it completely stiffs. But I've done okay in that respect. And the playing live really does help keep the name alive. Even though we don't call it the Alan Parsons Project, we call it the Alan Parsons Live Project, which is kind of a salute to Eric Wolfson, who was the other half of the Alan Parsons Project. It was just the two of us, really.
So how do you plan to market the record such that people are aware of it and will hear it?
I'm very much reliant on the label, which is Frontiers Records out of Italy. They have a lot of rock acts on their roster. I'm also very aware of the power of social media these days. I mean, if we post on our own Facebook site, you know, it'll get some attention, and we can make it reach other websites as well. That's great, you know. That's the way to promote something these days. It's all about the internet.
And to what degree are you personally active, or you have other people do it for you?
I do. Most of the time, I have other people do it.
Okay, so
one of whom is my wife, one of whom is my son-in-law. So
you have this album with the Italian company. Did they pay for the record, or did you pay for the record?
They paid me an advance, and I paid for it.
And at the end of the day, you're going to be in the black or the red on the record?
That remains to be seen. I haven't done the accounts yet. I'm hoping it'll be close to break even, at least.
And what about your royalty stream? How's that doing?
Really good. You know, the Alan Parsons Project catalog, both for sound recording and publishing, is very much alive and doing well, and it's become something I rely upon. it's strong. It's great. And
do you still own your own publishing?
I never did. I never did. It was assigned to publishers. I mean, of course, I own rights to receive royalties on those. On those entities, but no, I don't own any of my copyrights.
So if there's 100 cents in the dollar, how much that goes to you?
Hmm. Based on a record sale?
Based on a song. If there's 100, an artist might own their publishing, pay an administrator somewhere between 3% and 10%. The other 90 is them. An artist may have a deal with a publisher, and the publisher owns the copyright. They take 50%. The artist who wrote it get 50%. Also, if they co-wrote it, they end up with 25%. So in this publishing and a song, how much do you ultimately get in a revenue stream?
I think we're at 70% on publishing.
Okay, so that's good. That's a good number. How about the issue of regaining the copyright of your Alan Parsons Project's records? Have you gone down that road?
We've done what is called termination, which means that we ultimately get rights to it at a certain point, but. I don't think I'll ever literally claw back all the copyrights. I don't think that's going to happen. But I know it's fashionable to sell one's rights these days. I mean, everybody's doing it, and I've been thinking about it, but no firm decisions yet.
What would be your motivation to do it or not do it?
Well, it's that big M word again. I mean, it's money in your pocket, you know. I'm living very comfortably, you know, now with the current live shows and the current record sales. But you know, if there's a way of supplementing that income overnight, that'd be very nice. I'm not getting any younger either. I mean, you know, I'm 73. A nice little few $1 million, you know, back in the bank would be very nice. Might consider buying a second home or something, you know.
Although, of course, if you'd sold them recently and invested the proceeds with the market crash, you know, that would have worked against you. But, okay, so let's go back to the beginning. What were your growing up circumstances like?
I was an only child. Both my parents were musical. My dad played piano and flute, and my mother played a Celtic harp. And there was always music in my household. My dad was always playing classical music, which is why my knowledge of classical music is pretty good. And you know, I went to good schools in London. Prep school called the Hall, and went on to what the English would call a public school, but it's very much a private school. That was Westminster, you know, Westminster School, which was adjacent to Westminster Abbey in London, so a very sort of prestigious location. But I left at 16. I was considered by a vocational guidance person to be unsuitable to continue to the age of 18 and not to go to college or anything. So I left at 16, went to...
Well, before you go there, what'd your parents say when the guidance counselor said, get out of here?
I think they supported me on it. I mean, my school reports were dreadful. You know, he has no interest in this subject. You know, He's slacking. He will not do his homework and all that kind of stuff. You know. So yeah, it surprised me. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be hating school for at least another 2 years. But I really hadn't considered the option of leaving school. And I mean, Americans use the expression high school dropout. I suppose that's what I was really. But I was. A dropout from a public school, a prestigious English public school, you know, right up there amongst Eton, Harrow, St. Paul's, all big public schools, as we call them. So I was an unusual dropout.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What kind of kid were you growing up? Popular, unpopular, loner, into your own things? Usually single kids have their own unique perspective in life.
I had a good childhood. I wasn't bullied at school, if that's what you mean. But I mentioned I wasn't an only child, and I had lots of friends. I did okay. My parents lived in an area of London which was fairly upper middle class. Actually, a very Jewish area. I'm not Jewish myself, but we lived in a substantially Jewish area, and I generally had a good childhood. I enjoyed my father had a sort of passion for gadgetry and building things, and I think that's kind of rubbed off on me as well. And I learned a great deal from him.
Needless to say, music was revolutionized with the Beatles and the British invasion. To what degree were you growing up paying attention to popular music, and what was your experience?
I was very, very into pop music. I started taking a real interest in about 1957, 58. Distinctly remember a friend of mine picking up Oh, Carol by Neil Sedaka, whatever year that is. I think that's probably around that time, 57, 58. I was a huge fan of Cliff and the Shadows, Cliff Richard, that is. In terms of American music, I was listening to Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, of course. So yeah, I was there. I was there at the beginning of pop.
And to what, you know, it was a seismic event when the Beatles came to America. What was your experience in the UK?
I was still at school. I was the biggest Beatle fan you could ever imagine. I mean, I really was very, very, very into their music right from the beginning. It's right from Me to You and Love Me Do through to their ultimate breakup.
So, did you play a musical instrument growing up?
I took piano lessons. I didn't particularly enjoy learning piano from a teacher. I was more interested in playing by ear. And I did the same for the flute. The good thing about it is it taught me musical notation, which otherwise I might not have been able to use in later life. I use musical notation now to a substantial degree, especially for orchestral arrangements and so on. But it was a good thing that I did have piano and flute lessons. played in an orchestra at school as well. So, plenty of musical events going on in my childhood.
So you get pushed out of school at 16. On one level, you're thrilled you don't have to go two more years. What goes through your head then? What are you going to do?
I somehow knew that I would be in the entertainment industry somewhere. I'd given consideration to sound. You know, I didn't really know what a recording engineer was back then. But I said I'd like to work with sound, and I also considered television. I actually filled in forms for the BBC, you know, to become a TV cameraman, you know, to be trained as a TV cameraman. But that just went by the wayside. And I did a similar thing with EMI. I knew EMI was a big record company. So my first job after leaving school was with EMI.
Was that a hard job to get? Because from the outside, you know, people are salivating for jobs like that.
It was actually an apprenticeship scheme. It wasn't, I started in a research lab, which was making television camera tubes. It was a very technical job. I learned how to do glass blowing, which was interesting. That just taught me what industry was like. I mean, everybody else in the department, that TV camera tube department, was at least 10 years older than me. So I was the youngster, you know. But I got on well. I got on all right.
And how did you get from there to the studio?
Well, there are two more stages. The TV research lab was in Hayes in Middlesex, which is west of London, about 15 miles west of central London. I then transferred to a department called Tape Records, which was great as far as I was concerned. They were very involved with listening to EMI product, duplicating EMI product. The department was actually devoted to manufacturing mono versions of their product on tape, on little 3-inch or five inch plastic spools, and they were actually very good sounding products. But I worked in that department, helping to maintain tape machines and so on. But then I got into a copying room where Abbey Road would send their latest efforts down to us to be duplicated for foreign countries. So I was literally one of the very first people to hear Sergeant Pepper from the master tape before anybody in the great wide world had ever even heard of it, let alone listened to it.
So how do you end up in the studio?
Well, the studio was thankfully a department associated with this tape records department where I was working. And I simply wrote to the manager and said, I've been working for EMI since 1965. I'm now in tape records. I would very much appreciate a visit to Abbey Road to see what goes on, and if there were any vacancies, I'd be very interested. That same week, he receives a letter. I was invited to an interview, and 2 weeks later, I walked up those steps for the first time, and I became a trainee engineer at Abbey Road Studios.
Well, you know, as time went on, that was first step in most studios was the T-boy, but you were part of a larger system. What were your duties, and to what degree were they instructing you when you started there?
I, like most of the Abbey Road engineers, I started in the tape library, literally just logging in tapes that arrived and logging out tapes that people asked for. Fairly mundane tasks, but it taught me the importance of of correctly identifying what's on the tape box, what's on a tape, because it's terrifying sometimes to see how little detail goes into marking up a tape box. And I actually ended up writing a book called The Master Tape Book, which emphasized that particular importance. So literally probably only a month in the tape library, then I was allowed to be a fly on the wall for sessions. The very first session I sat in on was a band called The Gods, and musicologists will tell you that, oh yes, The Gods, that was Ken Hensley's first band, which it was, but he was a keyboard player, not a guitarist, as he was in Uriah Heep.
So how long was it before you got to touch anything?
Oh, quite a while. Well, no, actually, I mean, you say touch anything. I was allowed on to touch a tape machine, because that's essentially what I was training for, to be a tape operator, assistant engineer. So I got to know, the workings of the studio four track machines. Most sessions were four track when I first arrived. The Beatles were there doing the White Album just as I arrived. Some of which was eight track, but it was very, very much a lash up to use an eight track machine with a four track console. But I didn't really get to see any of that. It was sometime later that I actually got to record with Paul McCartney. That was years later, but. The experience of training under the great engineers like Jeff Emerick and Peter Vince, Peter Bowne, Peter Mew, Ken Scott, who of course you all know went on to be a very successful producer with David Bowie, just watching them, and then I was let loose probably 2.5 years into my employment at Abbey Road with the Hollies. I'd done a bunch of sessions with the Hollies as their tape operator, as their second engineer. But their engineer was double booked, and they offered me the job for the first time. You know, my first real engineering gig, and it went okay. I mean, I listen back to it now and I think, oh, if only, but it came out pretty good.
And were you thrilled just to be in the belly of the beast, or very quickly did that fall away and you were just doing a job?
Oh no, I was totally into it. No, it didn't feel like a job as well at all. I was very, very much into what I was doing, and I would work, crazy hours in order to just to enjoy myself. I mean, it's the best job in the world.
And had anyone taught you how to use the board, or you just observed, and when the other guy was double booked, you sat down to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty good idea how the console effectively worked, but the Abbey Road engineers used to be known as balance engineers, and that's really what the balance engineers did. They deal with the mix between instruments. So it was right to use the word balance. But my first ventures into engineering all came from the experience of watching others.
Okay, I have a question. You know, when the Beatles CDs first came out in the 80s, the early albums, everyone was shocked how good they sound. But if you look at the equipment, it seems so primitive. Why was the sound so good?
Good engineering, just solid good engineering. That's what it was all about. I mean, it's extraordinary that those early albums were done on 4-track at best. I think the first album was done 2-track, so they would record, you know, a backing track, bass, drums, guitars, and then they would add the vocals, and that was it. That was the master tape. And I'm sure you've heard the so-called stereo versions, early stereo versions of those albums. All the music is on the left and the vocals are on the right, and they call it stereo. Crazy.
So what happened after the Hollies?
Well, I started to, you know, get more work with the Hollies, plenty of work with them. And it wasn't really very long until I had until, you know, the Dark Side of the Moon sessions. Really, that was pretty soon after that period. But you know, the important step that happened between me being a tape op and being an engineer was being sent down to the Beatles studio in Savile Row to tape up for them. So that was the first Beatles experience. And I was, of course, on the roof for the rooftop session, which was a magnificent day. I will never forget that. So I continued after that. I spent a period engineering and tape opping. You know, I wasn't considered a fully fledged engineer really until Dark Side of the Moon. That's when it all came together.
Okay, so you're there at the Beatles studio. We just had this exhaustive Get Back movie. To what degree did you like it, not like it, and did it conform with your remembrance of what happened there?
The Let It Be movie was I found it really sort of depressing. I don't think it represented what was going on very well. But I think Peter Jackson's movie is it's not only complete, but it's it gives a much brighter picture of what went on during that period. And I'm in it. I'm in Get Back. You see me credited on screen as Alan Parsons' tape operator. I was very, very pleased about that. I actually met Peter Jackson a few months before the release, and he showed me a couple of clips. It was great. He's a lovely guy and very talented. And you can't believe the improvement in quality that he managed to get between the 16 mil film and what you see in the Get Back series.
And what was your involvement with Abbey Road?
At the time of the Get Back
Abbey
sessions?
Road, the Abbey Road album by the Beatles.
Oh, I see. I was tape up. There were two main engineers, Jeff Emmerich and Phil McDonald. But you know, I was there interacting with the band occasionally. Paul or John might, you know, say, "Can you play that again?" or whatever. You know, so I wouldn't call it establishing a huge friendship, but we were, you know, business associates. A great experience to watch them at work, see how their minds worked and what they could achieve. It was actually interesting that on Abbey Road they weren't often all there together. It tended to be one Beatle at a time coming in to polish off their own compositions. And they would have had to be there together to do the backing tracks, but all the later overdubs were tended to be solitary experiences by one Beatle alone.
Needless to say, these are legendary records that the audience has contemplated literally for decades, half a century, and you watch the Get Back movie and they seem to be so fanciful, just writing in the studio, and we'll see what goes on. What was your experience of the creative process?
Well, you know, I didn't really see them songwriting. I mean, I don't know what their process was for songwriting. I mean, I think it was well established by Abbey Road that John was writing his songs and Paul was writing his songs. It was no longer a genuine Lennon McCartney situation, even though the credits continued to say Lennon McCartney. So I can't really answer what the processes they went through to write a song, but I certainly got to see the ideas they had to make each song different or to make it sound as good as it does on the final mix. I mean, there was a lot of work after the basic tracks on everything, including orchestra for the first time. I think they'd never had a really full size orchestra perform on their music before.
So how'd you get the gig on Dark Side of the Moon?
I had been previously working with them on Atom Out Mother. I tape opped the whole thing until it was mixing time. Peter Bowne, their engineer, again, very, very great engineer. He was unable to do mixing sessions, and they very graciously just said, "Alan, would you like to have a go at it? Because you know the music," which I did. You know, I knew every note. If they'd brought in one of the other engineers, it might have been a more complicated process. But I mixed it. They were happy with it, and that ultimately led to me getting the gig for Dark Side of the Moon.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, they had singles hits. Originally, Syd Barrett was in the band. That didn't translate to America. Then they had all these records on Harvest, Umma Gumma, Atom Heart Mother. From a outside perspective, it seemed that Dark Side of the Moon was definitely a different direction. Was that the perception in the studio, or was this just another Pink Floyd album and it turned out to be such a gargantuan success?
I think everybody recognized it was different, and I think at the end of the day, everybody thought it was without a doubt their best work to date. But I don't think any of us, myself included, thought that we'd still be talking about it 50 years later. I mean, it's really unbelievable.
And other than operating the board, what were your contributions?
Well, a few bits and pieces. I came up with the clocks idea for time, because I'd previously recorded the clocks in an antique shop not far from the studios, which was ostensibly for a sound effects record, which I think got released but sold about 10 copies. we took all these chiming clocks and ticking clocks and synchronized them all together. Each clock was recorded separately, and just literally pressing the play button at a particular moment to make them synchronize, striking at the same time. So that was one little contribution, which, it's fairly major, fairly memorable section of the album. the loop on the loop on Money was quite painstakingly assembled. We amassed a number of sounds, like dropping a bag of coins on the wooden floor in number two studio, tearing up paper, the cash register, of course, and we made these continuous loops, but they sounded when the first couple of loops we tried sounded terrible. There was no sort of rhythm to it, and we discovered that the only way to make it rhythmically correct was to actually take a ruler and measure a precise length of tape that would be spliced onto the next similarly measured splicing tape. And that's how it ended up. That what you hear on the intro, and ultimately what they played to. They played to that loop. There was no click track or anything, or any metronome. They literally just played to that loop. Although it faded out soon after the intro, they then went freeform.
Now, if you go online, there's pushback from Roger Waters relative to your contribution. By the same token, he pushes back on everything. You have any thoughts about that?
What, saying that my contribution was limited or nil
Or essentially that you were just doing what you're doing would have been successful with anybody. It was really much is about them, and that you've been trading on your work thereafter.
Yeah, that's Roger. I think I can safely say that David and Nick have always been very supportive of my various exploits. They've always maintained that I did a nice job on Dark Side of the Moon, and so much so that David actually played on my first solo album.
So, what was the experience of being involved in such a successful record? You're a guy who's unknown, and then all of a sudden, you have the biggest album in the world. And how did that affect your career?
Oh, it was very positive on my career. I was actually offered a job. I mean, I had been when the album came out. I was on the road with them. I was doing their live sound as well as occasional studio sessions. We went back into the studio to do the famous Household Objects album, which never happened, which never really went anywhere. But yes, the phone started to ring. People wanted to work with me, and I was getting into production at that time, early 75. So not long after the success of Dark Side of the Moon, and thankfully my earliest productions met with considerable success, and that was the path to producing further acts and ultimately the Alan Parsons Project.
And how did you end up working with McCartney on Red Rose Speedway?
Well, that was just essentially a, an extension of, you know, we knew each other from Abbey Road. He knew of my my work with Pink Floyd, I think, although I'm not I'm not very good on comparing dates, but I think I'd probably already done Dark Side of the Moon by the time I started working with him. But we always got on well.
Well, like on Red Rose Speedway with Big Barn Bed, etc. To what degree? Because this is a guy who cut records totally by himself. So what was your role on those records?
He looked towards the his engineers. You know, he worked them hard. Or any engineer that's worked with Paul will tell you this. You know, he's not particularly technical. He can't describe in technical terms what he's looking for. He would just say, "Oh, let's make the snare drum sound better." You know, and I would sort of move the mic, try a different mic, try a different EQ. You know, and you know, I think ultimately he probably got the result he wanted. But yeah, he was pretty demanding, you know, working his engineers hard.
So how'd you meet Eric Wolfson?
Eric had been coming in and out of Abbey Road as a producer. He and I, I mean, I worked on a couple of sessions he was involved with, and I sensed his great expertise on the music business. And we got chatting, and he said, "You know, what you need is a manager." And I went, "Oh, really? I didn't know engineers had or producers even had managers." But yes, I became one of the first engineer producers to have a manager. So that's how it all started. And then literally in no time after we signed the management deal, we were looking towards making an album of Edgar Allan Poe stories.
A little bit slower. You make a management deal. How do you end up making an album about Edgar Allan Poe's stories? Where does that come from?
It was very much Eric's idea. He had had a passion for the work of Poe as a child, as had I. I mean, I read a whole bunch of his short stories myself, and I thought it was a great idea to make a concept album based on the work of Poe. We really didn't anticipate at the time that it would be known as the Alan Parsons Project. The Alan Parsons Project was literally just a descriptive term for what for the album we were making. I honestly didn't think it would become the name of the act. But that's what Russ Regan, the president at the American label, he said. No, I think the act is the Alan Parsons Project. We're gonna call it Tales of Mystery Imagination, the Alan Parsons Project. Yeah.
And what did Eric say about that?
Well, he in later life he said that was the best decision he ever made to put my name as the artist. And he also said it was the worst decision because he didn't get the attention or the accolade that I did, but yes, he often said that in interviews. It was my best decision, also my worst decision.
So, you decide to make a record. I think it's on Flying Charisma label in UK. It's on 20th Century in the US. 20th Century was not a good label. How'd you end up on 20th Century?
That was because the band Ambrosia had signed with 20th. There was also another connection. 20th had signed Carl Douglas, who was the kung fu fighting guy. So essentially Ambrosio, Carl Douglas, and Eric going to talk to the president at the label, and that was good enough for him to sign us for the first album, you know, hits with Carl Douglas, hits with Ambrosia. You know.
Okay, so you were involved with Ambrosia before Tales of Mystery and Imagination. How'd you get involved with Ambrosia?
That's an interesting story. The first I knew of Ambrosia was a phone call from a guy called Gordon Parry, who had been their sort of protege. He was a classical music engineer at Decca. And I just happened to be passing the telephone at the commissionaire's desk, the security guy's desk. And I picked up the phone and said, Abbey Road Studios, can I help you? And this voice from Gordon Parry said, I'd like to speak to Alan Parsons. I said, yeah, this is Alan. And ended up being a 15-minute conversation. He would invite me to come over to Los Angeles to work with this band. And it just so happened that phone call came when I was already booked to go to LA for the Grammys, because I'd been nominated for Dark Side of the Moon to get an engineering Grammy. And during my visit, I went to hear their album and liked it very much. And then the offer came in to not to stay on and mix their album then. It was a few months later. It was still work in progress at that time. But I loved it. And mixing their first album led to my producing their second album, Somewhere I Never Traveled.
So the first album, and I think that's their best work, the iconic song, of course, is Holding On to Yesterday. What did you do in the mix to make to make it sound so good?
I give credit to the engineers that recorded it. I mean, I think it's a nicely executed mix. I really can't tell you tangible expressions what I actually did. I mean, I didn't have any magic buttons or magic equipment. You know, the equipment was still fairly primitive in those days. Digital delays and so on still hadn't really hit the market. But it was a nice recording. You know, the violin part is lovely, and David Pack did a great vocal.
So you decide to make this record with Eric Wolfson about Edgar Allan Poe. What are the next steps in terms of creation of the music, getting a record deal, casting the record? Walk me through that.
Well, we did the deal with Russ Regan of 20th Century at the music conference in Cannes in France, which is called MIDEM. And essentially, we had a meeting with Russ and told him that we had this idea to make a record based on Edgar Allan Poe stories, and he loved the idea and essentially said, "Yeah, off you go. Here's a check," which was great. And it's interesting when he first heard the album. I think he was which we also did in France, but that was in Paris. He actually used the words, "I like it, but I don't love it." But that was on a first hearing. And then after hearing it a few more times, he said, "Oh my God, this is best album I've ever heard." And, you know, he totally changed his stance on that.
How did one half of the album end up being instrumental and the other album being a traditional song bass rock record?
That was probably more of my influence than anything else. I mean, historically, I've been, you know, much more responsible for instrumental tracks than vocal tracks. But of course, a lot of that time is taken up by the Fall of the House of Usher, which is a purely orchestral piece. That's something I really enjoyed. Putting a classical orchestra together for music I'm responsible for. So that was a big moment. There are various orchestral and instrumental interludes in the album, which in commercial terms, they're not considered necessary in commercial terms. And when we eventually signed with Clive Davis, he was always looking for hit songs. You know, he would never have considered an instrumental track for a single. But I think in the early periods of the APP, Tales of Mystery, I, Robot, Pyramid, I did make a more substantial contribution as a composer, particularly for the instrumental tracks.
And on that album, you have Arthur Brown of the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. How does he end up singing?
A business partner of Eric's, knew him. It was a great afternoon when he came in to sing The Telltale Heart. We played him Eric's guide vocal, which is incredibly simple. He says, "You should have seen him running alone within the night." You know, and he heard it and was very down to earth and said, "Yeah, I think I've got it." Goes into the studio, goes onto the mic, we play the track, and then suddenly it's wow! <You know? laughs> we were really worried that he wouldn't find himself, he wouldn't find his crazy world for our track, but he very much did. And I think it's a standout track on the first album. Love it.
And then how did you end up using John Miles? Did you have a pre-existing relationship with him?
I did, yes. Had a big success with his first two singles and his first album. Sadly, not in America, but did incredibly well with John in the UK and the rest of Europe. Incredibly talented singer. Sadly, we lost him a few months ago. He died of cancer three or four months ago. But I always regarded him as a great singer, and that's why I invited him back on several occasions to sing other songs.
And tell me about the use of the vocoder on The Raven.
The vocoder was actually an EMI creation. There was a big audio research department at Hayes where I had worked earlier. In that TV camera department, they came up with this box that we had kind of asked for. We said, "How can we add a vocal to an instrument and make it sound like it's one thing?" And there was this series of stories on record that was called Sparky's Magic Piano. I don't know if you
I don't know remember. That one, no.
It was an American production, but there was literally a talking piano. It's very cleverly done, and I think we all hoped that that's what it would achieve, but in the end it just made a voice sound very electronic, and it worked well for The Raven. I mean, We spent a long time toing and froing, trying different buttons and different settings and so on. But I think it was pretty much the first vocoder used on a record.
So you have this very extensive cover, Hypnosis cover, in the UK. In America, I don't think there's a gatefold at all. And then shortly thereafter, the album just has a cover of you on it.
Yeah, well, I was furious about that. I really was. And when people give me that second simplified sleeve to sign, I kind of go grunt my disapproval. You know, you should have the original cover, not this cover. But The gatefold did exist, I think, worldwide, but it was very extravagant. Yeah, it was, you know, this tracing paper between pages and stuff. And it was a very lavish package, but it was great. I loved it.
Okay. I love that album. I bought it originally as a promo, and they had an unlimited supply at my store, and I would buy them for other people.
Huh?
What was the perception of success on that first album from your viewpoint?
I mean, I was amazed. I mean, I thought it, you know, we thought the album was good, but we thought it would literally fall by the wayside. Or, you know, but you know, we're a new act. We have high hopes, the success of Tales of Mystery and the continued success of the act through several other albums with Arista. I never ceased to be amazed at the success and was always slightly trepidatious, shall we say. But it was always great news that it was getting on playlists and that it was actually shifting copies out of record stores. It was always a great relief and I was proud. I was very proud.
So you have one record on 20th Century. How do you end up bouncing from there to Arista?
Well, the first album deal, much to Russ Regan's chagrin, I think, was it was just a single album deal. So we were free to go to anyone. You don't take a cold meeting with Clive Davis lightly, but that's what happened. He invited us to a dinner in London at a famous restaurant called Lorenzo's. And, essentially he said he wanted to sign us for a multi-album deal. And, not soon after that meeting, I think Eric flew to New York and did the business, and there we were. We were signed to Arista for our second album, iRobot.
So at the time, Arista was still just starting. He had Patti Smith. There was a lot of goodwill. Even though he'd gotten fired, he'd written his book. But as time went on, as you referenced earlier, he was all about hits, and he was famous for meddling with the music of artists. Now, ultimately, he ended up being with, top 40 artists who may not have even written the songs. What was your experience working with Clive Davis?
He always wanted a single off every album. He wanted to make sure that it was commercial in his eyes. He would always suggest edits. He would even have his own people do edits, some of which worked well, some of which sounded absolutely horrible. But he liked to be close to the music, really identifying the structure of a song and saying, the chorus doesn't happen until a minute and a half in. We need it to happen less than a minute in, and stuff like that. So, but you can't argue. He knew what he was doing. He had the ear for hits. He really did.
So you would listen to him, you would change the songs and be okay with that?
It was usually a compromise. I never put anything out that I was actually, actually unhappy with, but I think we just kept each other happy. I mean, if the compromise was necessary on an edit he never sought to have us remix, which of course, labels are famous for telling acts to remix their songs, but he never did that. Just the structure. Just when the chorus happens, when the solo happens. We had a long solo, for example, on Games People Play, and we cut that down, and I was fine with that. And it was mutual decisions on the edits, and I think both of us were happy in the end. I never put anything out that I was seriously unhappy with.
Now, it wasn't like every album had hits on it. There were ups, there were downs. Was he ever angry with you or lost faith in you, or you felt like a second or third class citizen?
No. I always had a great relationship with Klein. Never a harsh word.
Okay. And then ultimately Sirius becomes the Chicago Bulls anthem and becomes a sports anthem. Did that happen totally independent of you? And what did you think of that?
I had absolutely no idea. It certainly wasn't written as a sports theme. It was written on a Fairlight computer instrument, which was very high tech back in the early 80s. And it was just an intro to Eye in the Sky. But somebody at the Chicago Bulls said this will make great walk on music for Michael Jordan, and that happened, and several other sports teams followed. It baffles me. I mean, I think it works great, but it certainly was not the last thing on my mind that it would be used for sports. But it continues to be used to this day.
And is that lucrative, the fact they do?
It's lucrative in terms of TV advertising, use on TV shows. American Idol, for example, use it occasionally. But sadly, when it's used in sports games, in stadiums and so on, there is no record of it. There's no money change hands, because it just goes into a big pot, which is shared by all musicians and writers, BMI, ASCAP, so on. CSAC, which is the society I'm with, they would be angry if I hadn't mentioned that. It just goes into this general pot. It's not considered a sync license. That's what's valuable to a writer and a musical act, to get what is known as a sync license. That means the sound has to be licensed to go with a picture. And considering that the ball game really is all about the people on the court, not a video.
So you're making all these records. They come out under the moniker Alan Parsons Project. What do you do, and what does Eric do?
Well, we both came to the studio in the early stages of each album with what we'd worked on our own in the, leading up to that first day. Eric would usually have a cassette with a rough version of the song as he saw it at the time. I also made demos. By the time Eye in the Sky came along, I was back in London, having lived in Monaco for a couple of years. We just came in and sort of say, here's what I've got, what have you got? And then we would collaborate, and I was famous for changing the structures of his songs, or changing the key or changing the tempo or whatever. That's sort of borne out by the recent releases of box sets, which include Eric's songwriting diaries, as we call them, very sort of basic piano and vocal versions of songs, almost bearing no relation to the final product sometimes.
So would one say that he essentially wrote all the songs?
I'm slightly reluctant to say that he wrote all the songs, because there were occasions when I made very definite co-writing compositions, co-writing contributions, shall I say. But yes, I mean, he was a talented songwriter. And part of that talent as a songwriter was the ability to write lyrics. I wasn't strong on lyrics, so I would say that if you want to break down the music and the lyrics into proportions, I would say Eric was maybe 90% the musical composer, maybe 80% the musical composer, but 100% of the lyrics would be composed by him. I probably contributed one line or two during the course of 10 albums.
So, like when you talked about the first album, you're talking about the instrumental second side. That was your thing. Did you actually compose that, or did he compose that, or did you do it together?
It was, I think I give Andrew Powell, who actually orchestrated it and made it performable. It was designed to echo a piece by Claude Debussy, who had written a piece called The House, based on the same story, on the fall of the House of Usher. I think it was unfinished, and we kind of borrowed from Debussy in a couple of places. And I think it's magical. I think it's very Debussy, if you know his music. But we took a risk. We 7 or 8 minutes of orchestral music opening the second side of an album. That was pretty risky, I think.
Now, ultimately, there's a dispute with Arista, and you deliver a quick album to get out of the contract, which ultimately doesn't come out at that time. What went down around then?
Eric was always the businessman, and I told you I never had a harsh word with Clive Davis, but I think Eric probably did with Clive and with the business affairs people, and the relationship went somewhat sour after the Eve album and probably the Gaudi album as well, and we just made an instrumental contractual obligation album, and that ultimately resulted in a lawsuit which got settled out of court and we re-signed. So there was a happy ending to it, but the album in question, the Sicilian Defense, is quite definitely my least favorite album of all time by any artist.
Okay, so you make Tales of Mystery and Imagination. To what degree are you still getting calls to produce an engineer, and how do you handle those?
I get a lot of calls. I get sent CDs or sometimes little memory sticks with people's music all the time. I mean, there's no shortage of work for me should I choose to take people up on it. But I keep busy with just the things I generate.
But even back in the 70s, same thing when you were making the transition?
I had a couple of production acts that I was successful with. Pilot was one. John Miles, who we've already mentioned. I also did three albums with Al Stewart, which did very well. So I kept busy. I was never bored.
But you weren't saying, now I'm an act, I don't want to produce records anymore? Or did you eventually say that?
Oh, no. I was always, even with the Alan Parsons Project, I was the producer. And that was a given.
I'm talking about third parties.
Third parties, I was happy to be to take on production work with other artists, but I couldn't take on everything that was offered, clearly, because the project kept me busy, and things like Pilot, John Miles, and Al Stewart took up a lot of my time.
Okay. So we hit the 21st century. You end up releasing a course for engineers. How does that come together, and what exactly is it?
It's called The Art and Science of Sound Recording. We spent 2 years assembling a DVD course. DVD was the format of choice as we prepared this this series of videos. It stemmed from a similar project that my partner in the venture, a British guy called Julian Colbeck, who I first met as a musician on a session for a band I was working with. He had done a similar educational project on VHS tape, probably a full 10, 12 years earlier. And he just came to me and said, would you like to make a video recording course? And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. He said, I don't think it'll take very long. We'll get an advance from somebody and it'll take about 3 months to put together. We didn't realize that it would be 2 years and 9 hours of of educational stuff. But it was fun to do. And it's still very much alive. It's still being used not only by interested individuals, but by schools, colleges, you know, that have engineering courses.
So if one watches it, what will they take from it?
Hopefully give them a better idea of what goes on in a recording studio. I mean, I think a lot of people think the recording studio is this mysterious place where you you go and play your song and then out pops a CD out of a slot, at the bottom of the studio equipment. People just don't really understand what goes on. It's very difficult to represent a recording session in such a way that it's interesting. I mean, being a fly on the wall in a studio recording is incredibly uninteresting. It just seems that the tape keeps rolling and everything sounds the same and it goes on and on and on. But we try in this series, I think, to lift the veil and show people what really happens. How a vocal is recorded and compiled, how you achieve certain drum sounds, keyboard sounds, guitar sounds. It's designed to be useful to novices as well as experienced engineers. So we worked quite hard to try and make it entertaining as well as informative.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Set sail and save right away when you book your next Disney cruise vacation with UndercoverTourist.com. Undercover Tourist is your secret for savings on all Disney Resorts vacations. And now, fun in the sun with Disney Cruise Lines. How about enchanting entertainment or an exclusive visit to Castaway Key? Anything's possible aboard a Disney cruise vacation. Book now with UndercoverTourist.com, an authorized seller, and get a free in-room decor package with your Disney Cruise Line booking. Plus, exclusive savings at checkout. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
How'd you end up living in the United States? When did you come here? And how'd you end up in Santa Barbara?
I had bought a house in Montecito, which is a adjunct to Santa Barbara, back in the 90s with my ex-wife and my two sons. It became clear that my ex-wife was not comfortable in America. So we went back to the UK. Then soon after we got back, I met Lisa, my now wife, and I decided I wanted to live with her, and she had two daughters, and she came to the UK for a while. We lived in a house just outside London.
You met her where?
I met her in Maryland. Maryland. It's a big shed there in Maryland. I'm trying to think of the name of it.
Merriweather Post?
Merriweather Post. You got it. That's the one. That's where we met. And when we decided we were going to live together, we considered all the options. I think we all said California was the most likely. And because of my previous experience in Santa Barbara, I really liked Santa Barbara and do to this day. So in 2003, we got married, and the rest is history.
And how did you end up deciding to build a studio?
I really did not build a studio to the same specification as the one I now have. Until I did build this one, I was just working in rooms in our house. Valley Path was just literally done in two adjacent bedrooms, and I think I resisted it because I knew how expensive a building a studio is, and the one I'm speaking from now is no exception. It's cost a great deal of money, but I'm really glad that I did do it because the work that I did in the early years of my solo careers, I think suffered through not having a decent studio. But I'm really, really delighted with the results I'm getting in this new studio.
Now, if one goes online, there's a whole website for the studio. It seems like it's in the middle of nowhere in Santa Barbara. How'd you end up with that property? Is it contiguous with your home property? What's the story there?
The home studios have always been home studios. Really, really not very extravagant equipment wise at all. If I needed a proper studio, I would go to a commercial studio to work. So it was more of a sort of environment to listen to stuff, compose stuff. I'm really glad that I made the decision a couple of years ago to build this new studio. I'm very, very, very happy with it, and it's now state of the art because I've put this new system, which everybody in the industry is talking about, Dolby Atmos. So,
okay, but the property that it's on—did you already own that property?
Yes, yeah, we bought this house in 2005, and we've been here ever since.
But the
17 years in the same house. I've never done that before.
The studio is not attached to the house you live in, correct?
Correct. It's an outbuilding.
You know, if you go online, it seems, and I've gotten other emails, seems like you're looking for third parties to book your studio. Are you, and to what degree are people using it?
I regard it as being fairly new as a commercial studio. I've had one or two clients in here. Seem to enjoy themselves. I don't let anybody in. I like to meet them and talk to them and find out what they want to do, rather than just do it on a strictly business basis. I won't do that, and I'll only have clients in here, if you can call them clients, when I know that I'm not in need of studio time myself.
Now, you know, so many studios have gone out of business. There's not only the sunk costs of the building and the equipment, you have to continue to update the equipment. There's ongoing equipment costs. Has that been your experience? How, you know, you have to budget for that?
Yes. I mean, it's not just recording equipment, it's musical equipment. There's always a new synth. There's always new microphones to check out, which baffles me because, you know, I've been making perfectly good recordings with my existing mic collection. I really don't need any new ones because they're never substantially different from the best microphones in my cupboard. there's a certain need to budget for new stuff, but I'm just as likely to buy a new synth or a new guitar as I am to buy a new preamp for the studio.
So prior to the internet era, the business was cohesive. There were a limited number of labels. If you weren't on a major label, you were far down the food chain. So at this point in time, do you feel part of the larger business, or are you really just in the Alan Parsons business?
I've kind of lost touch with the industry. When I was making albums with Arista, we were constantly in touch with press people, marketing people, so on and so on. Having said that, I'm doing the occasional interview to promote the album, which comes out this week. It's not a strong relationship with labels anymore. For live shows, I have to deal with agents, promoters, and that kind of stuff. But in terms of the recording industry, I'm not very in tune with what's going on. Don't spend a lot of time listening to modern music.
And do you keep in touch with all the people from the past, or are you pretty much a homebody just doing your own thing?
I try to. I try to stay in touch with people I've worked with in the past. John, of course, who I've already mentioned, died sadly a few months ago. We were always good friends, always in touch with each other. David Pack from Ambrosia has been a good friend ever since the first album, or my first album and his first album, which were released close to each other. Colin Blunstone, I bump into now and again. Last time I saw him was on a cruise, you know, a music cruise. Never saw Arthur Brown again after Tales of Mystery, but there we are. I try to keep in touch with people who are ultimately responsible in part to my success. So I will always be grateful for that.
Well, you have this new album, Alan. I wish you continued success, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're very welcome, Bob. Thank you. I look forward to hearing this on the air.
You bet. Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.